Great. Good morning, everyone. We are here to call the Human Services Committee to order. I will start with the top. We need to first take the roll. Ms. Hansen, if you would be so kind.
Absolutely. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Thank you. Chair Schultz is on the way. Vice Chair Bonner.
Present.
Lead Albright.
Morning, present.
Good morning. Representative Bolden.
Present.
Representative Burkle.
Present.
Thank you. Representative Fisher.
Fisher, present.
Representative Frederick.
Present.
Representative Hansen.
Hansen, present.
Thank you. Representative Keel.
Present.
Thank you. Representative Liebling.
Present.
Representative Mueller.
Present.
Good morning. Representative Knorr.
Present.
Representative Novotny.
Novotny's present.
Representative Pearson.
Pearson, present.
Representative Pinto.
Present.
Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen, present.
Representative Robbins.
Present.
Good morning. Representative Sandel.
Present.
Thank you. And Representative Schumacher.
Schumacher, present.
Thank you, sir. We have a quorum, Vice Chair Bonner.
Wonderful. And I failed to mention that we are calling this meeting in to order it pursuant to House Rule 10.01. Next, we need to move the minutes. Do I have a member that would like to move the minutes for March 9th, 2021?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Mueller. We'll move the minutes then. All those in favor, please unmute yourselves and say aye.
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 Any opposed? Any corrections or edits to the minutes that we need to make? All right, hearing none, we will move on to the next. I do have a couple of really quick announcements for today to get us going. Sorry, what happened to my, oh, here we go. First, I wanted to let everyone know that if we do not finish our bills by noon today, we will have a recess and return at 6 o'clock tonight. I know schedules are crazy this week, so certainly I suspect we'd all hope not to do that. but just letting everyone know that that is available if need be. We also have a full schedule today, so I want to ask everyone to be mindful of keeping questions and comments concise to make sure that we allow us to get through all of our testifiers today, and respectfully ask that members confine themselves to one question and a follow-up. And of course, as time permits, we can certainly circle back to hear additional questions as time allows. With that, we do have our first bill on the agenda today, which is HF 1273. We will have before us Representative Keeler needs to present another bill at 11, so we need to make sure that we are finished no later than 10:55. So just kind of queuing that up for the members. And so with that, the chair moves that HF 1273 be moved before the committee to be laid over for possible inclusion. Now that we have the bill before us, Representative Keeler, welcome to the committee. Would you like to tell us about your bill?
I would. Thank you, Madam Chair and members, for having me back. We're here today to talk about House File 1273. I want to start by just making a statement that Minnesota is number one in the nation when it comes to removal of our Native American children. This is not one of the things that we want to be number one with. 17 Native American children are removed to every one white student and one white youth. That is extremely appalling to me, and it should be a concern to all of you. One of the things that this bill does is it is removing the American Indian Ombudsperson from the current situation to a standalone office. The main reason that we feel this is important is many of you might know that as American Indian families, we fall under federal law and guidelines called ICWA, What ICWA does is it sets place into standards that our American Indian children, if removed from their parent guardian, that we have to follow really strict guidelines when it comes to placement. This is an effort that is bipartisan in nature. When it was heard in the Senate last week, it was 100% supported in the efforts, because again, we're not asking for more money. What we're doing is we're taking the 25% that's already allocated to our ombudsperson and moving it over to a standalone office so that we can remove the barriers that are in place in the current situation for us and our ombudsperson to continue to do this work that is extremely important for our current families and our future generations. I'm not going to talk much more about it other than stating that our sovereign nations are in full support of this. And it's one of the things that here in Minnesota we take pride in is our sovereign nation and government relationship. I'm going to pass it over to Tanya Long at this time, and she will give you some more information. Thank you.
Thank you, representatives. Good morning, all. Thank you for hearing me. I want to start with the history.
Ms. Long?
Yes.
Ms. Long, if you could, please state your full name for the record and any organizations that you're affiliated with. And please, we want to try to keep our remarks to 2 minutes. And with that, I will turn it to you.
Yes, my name is Tanya Long. I am the chair for the Community-Specific Board for American Indians Ombudsperson. I'm also a member of a federally recognized tribe, and I am a ICWA family advocate here in Minnesota. I want to say that the history of the office for all American Indian ombudspersons or for families was done in 1991, and then in 1994, the four of the ombudspersons came together in one office. At that time, each ombudsperson was responsible for the money that was allocated to them. And it continued until MMB changed their operating system, where the allocation came in one lump sum. However, the statute does say that each ombudsperson will work independently and be over in control over the monies allocated to them. I wanted to also let you know that there's 11 reservations in Minnesota. There's some in the northern, in the western, and in the metro area and southern area. This legislation doesn't change any structure or systems. Minnesota Indian Affairs Council, which is our tribal leadership, appoints the community-specific board, which are American Indians, are very culturally competent, working with the American Indian community, and we advise and assist the ombudsperson for American Indian families. Minnesota Indian Affairs is our appointing authority, and so nothing changes that. The money that the ombudsperson for this agency is asking is no additional money. It's a quarter of what is already allocated to the Office for Families that they receive now. The Governor Task Force for Child Protection recommended that the Office for Ombudspersons be restructured. That was also another reason for, I'm sorry, I'm nervous. Another reason for us to separate out. If you remember, the legislative auditor restructured the other councils of color. They made some recommendations, but the American Indian Affairs Council remained the same because of the tribal sovereign status of the tribal leaders. And so we asked that we be separated out too because of that sovereign status and the federal and state laws that applies specifically to American Indians with their political status. In 2020, after years of requesting more funding because of the disparities, there's huge disparities in the American Indian community and the African American community, the governor did increase the appropriation for the office for two investigators, and we're asking for a fourth of that general appropriation. because the reasoning, the rationale behind that was the disparities in those two communities. And this is one of the communities that is separating out. That's all I have.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Long. And let's see, is that, I believe that's the only testifier we have for the bill. It looks like we also have some individuals here from DHS, Children and Family Services, and Child Safety and Permanency available for questions. Do we have any questions from the members? And I'm sorry, I did not see whose hand was first. Ms. Yang, do we know who was first? Okay, well, I'll just take them in order then. Representative Albright, to your question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Keeler, thank you for bringing this bill forward. I also have as constituents the Midwakaden Sioux tribe in my district. I just want to thank you for your strong support of Native American families and their children. I would encourage the committee members to support this initiative.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Albright. Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just also wanted to thank Representative Keeler for bringing this bill today. I think the bill makes sense and also just respects the unique aspects of Indian tribes and people here in the state of Minnesota. And so appreciate the bipartisan support that this has in both chambers and for Representative Keeler leading this effort.
Very good. And Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Keeler, for bringing this bill. I did have just one question, because there is no fiscal note. Do you expect one? And also, if you could just talk about why we need the, I get why we need the separation of the Ombudsman's office, but then why the additional board? If you could just speak to that, just to better understand how this will flow. Thank you.
I'm sorry, what did you say?
Madam Chair.
Ms. Long?
Yes, I'm sorry. Did you say additional board? Was that your question?
Ms. Robbins, or Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, ma'am. It looks like in addition to separating, it establishes an American Indian specific board to oversee the separate ombudsperson. So I'm wondering why both layers of that are important. I'm sure they are, I just don't know why. Thank you.
Okay, Ms. Long, would you like to answer that?
Yes. This new legislation or the new agency or separating out does not create a new board. Currently, we have the community specific board for American Indian ombudsperson. Nothing has changed from that. The only thing that when I first read some different things going around was there's a confusion for me, and was that we're removing the community specific board and the American Indian ombudsperson from the present office for ombudspersons for families. As it stands right now, there are four community specific boards for each community that is represented. So it's not a new board. It's just removing us from that statute into a new statute.
Okay. Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Keeler.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Robbins. To answer your first question, there's not a fiscal note because we're not adding any additional information. I can work with our fiscal team to see how we transfer that, but there is no additional allocations being made here. And then I think the language that you're looking at is because we're basically ending one office and creating a new office. So in the language, it says create a board, but it's just transitioning from one to another.
Okay. Representative Robbins, did you have a follow-up? You're on mute, Representative Robbins.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. Thank you. No follow-up, and I appreciate the answers. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Are there any other members that have questions for Representative Keeler? If not, I actually have one of my own. Certainly, I think the legislators here today in the committee, we understand and appreciate the need to, of course, respect our sovereign nations and, of course, preserve cultural specific and appropriate parameters, particularly when it comes to child protection. I think we all certainly understand and appreciate that hard work. One of the things that I heard you say, Representative Keeler, in your opening statement is that there may be some barriers under the current structure that were maybe not allowing you to fulfill that mission. And I'm curious if you could speak a little bit to what some of those barriers are and how this new structure would help you to better serve the needs of the folks in your community.
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you for the question. I would love to talk about the barriers. I won't get too into the weeds with it because there's many of them, but I'll give some examples. The money that's allocated is designed for each individual ombudsperson to be able to allocate and use their money as needed to serve their communities. This is not a voting option. And what has happened is when our ombudsperson for American Indian Families, an example I'll give is in 2016 is when the federal law changed around ICWA, and there was a training that our ombudsperson needed to attend. And what happened was then the other three ombudspersons voted against the funding needed to go to this really crucial training, because again, we are under federal guidelines. And so when we're in a situation where it's being voted against 3-1 and we can't do the training that we need to support our families, that's a barrier. And then when there's the same thing happening for other travel that needs to take place around the state to do trainings for different social workers and different agencies that are working with our American Indian youth and making sure that we're following those guidelines, we're coming up against the same barriers that we're getting voted against in order to use our own funds that are allocated for us. And so moving to an individual office would allow us to be able to make those decisions in a timely manner, an effective way, and then obviously having our board and then being underneath MIAC allows us to make sure that we are in strong support and moving forward to do the best that we can without these other barriers of other ethnic agencies telling us that we can't do that or telling us that that's not appropriate for our children.
Okay. So it sounds like the barrier may be a little bit more need for autonomy, which certainly explains the need to separate and do that to better serve your community. So I certainly understand and respect that, and I know that in previous committees, we've had a number of conversations about making sure that folks are properly trained in ICWA, particularly folks that are dealing with child protection and how important that really is. All right, and with that, I am going to see, do we have any last questions for Representative Keeler before we give her closing statement? If not, all right. Representative Keeler, do you have any closing remarks before we go ahead and lay this bill over?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I just appreciate all of your willingness to learn and grow and support our American Indian youth. As I said at the very beginning, we have a large disparity here and we need to make sure that we invest in making a change for our next generations. As always, I value and appreciate each of you and hope that you all have a great day. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Keeler. This bill will be laid over for possible inclusion into the omnibus bill. And with that, we will move on to the next bill. Thank you, Representative Keeler, for being here today. And thank you to our testifier. With that, we are moving on to, let's see. Did we say that we have Representative Edelson here? Is she here? Maybe not. All right, then let's go ahead and go next to Representative Bierman. We have House File 1390, which is we'll bring before us. First, I'll move to adopt the division report from the Behavioral Health Policy Division. That does require a voice vote for members. Please unmute yourselves. All those in favor of accepting the division report, please say aye.
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 Any opposed?
Nay.
All right, it looks like the motion does carry and the division reports are adopted. Next, we'll make sure that this bill is before us. The intent here is to recommend that the House File 1390 be moved to the General Register. Now that we have it before the committee, members, this bill has been extensively discussed in our division. Representative Bierman, we have it before us. Please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, committee members. HF 1390 is the CCBHC policy bill. The CCBHC are the Minnesota Certified Community Behavioral Health Clinics, which are part of a new model of delivering integrated behavioral care to Minnesotans. Originally built under a federal demonstration, CCBHC model is moving into being a benefit under medical assistance. As the state's CCBHC model is moving into state plan authority, we are looking to update the Minnesota statute to align with the state plan, provide clarity in model structure, and update federal citations in the current law. The language changes in this bill are adding clarity and guidance to the current CCBH model. Many sections of new language come out of the state plan amendment submitted to CMS to align the statute with the state plan. HF 1390 would make the following policy changes to CCBHC statutes. Correcting federal citations, align statute language with Medicaid expectations and commitments, offers more structure to fit referral processes and partnerships, recommends a task force for future CCBHC licensure, and outlines and clarifies a new state-based quality performance structure. So, these are technical adjustments to state statutes conforming to CMS protocols. No changes to the proven CCBH model, nor any fiscal cost. I do not have any testifiers, but DHS and Ms. Palin from the Minnesota Association of Community Health Programs are in attendance to assist with member questions.
Wonderful. Thank you, Representative Bierman. And do we have any questions from members for Representative Bierman? Yes, Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just actually a point of question for you. Will this be laid over or is this going to another committee?
Sorry, I thought I had stated clearly that this would be actually is being referred to the General Register.
My apologies. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Did you have an additional question or follow-up, Representative Albright?
Madam Chair, I just wish everyone a great day.
Okay. Wonderful. All right. I am not seeing any additional questions from the members. If that being the case, Representative Bierman, would you like to kind of give a quick wrap up so that we can go ahead and vote?
Just to thank you for members' consideration. It's a good bill. It's a great program. Welcome your support. Thank you.
All right. Wonderful. And with that, we'll ask Ms. Hansen to take the role on the bill to recommend this to the General Register.
Okay. Chair Schultz is excused at the moment. Vice Chair Bonner?
Aye.
Bonner, aye. Lead Albright?
Aye.
Albright, aye. Representative Bolden?
Aye.
Bolden, aye. Representative Burkle?
Aye.
Burkle, aye. Representative Fisher?
Fisher, aye.
Thank you. Representative Frederick?
Aye.
Frederick, aye. Representative Hansen?
Hansen, aye.
Hansen, aye. Representative Keel?
Aye.
Keel, aye. Representative Liebling?
Aye.
Liebling, aye. Representative Mueller?
Aye.
Mueller, aye. Representative Noor?
Aye.
Noor, aye. Representative Novotny?
Novotny, aye.
Novotny, aye. Representative Pearson?
Pearson, aye.
Pearson, aye. Representative Pinto?
Aye.
Pinto, aye. Representative Rasmussen?
Rasmussen, aye.
Rasmussen, aye. Representative Robbins? Oh, Robbins, aye. I see you. Sorry. Representative Sandel?
Aye.
Handel, aye. Thank you, sir. Representative Schumacher.
Schumacher, aye.
Schumacher, aye. Thank you. Vice Chair Bonner, that's 18 ayes and one excused. You're on mute.
Thank you. And with that, we will move House File 1390 to the General Register. Congratulations, Representative Bierman. Your bill is on its way. Thank you. Next, we'll move right along. And I believe we do have Representative Edelson present now.
I'm here, Madam Chair.
All right. Well, then let me just go ahead and adjust a little bit here to the information on your bill here. All right, so next we will consider House File 740, which will be laid over for possible inclusion in the House or the Human Services Finance Bill. The chair moves that House File 740 before the committee for consideration. Representative Edelson, would you please or like to speak to your bill?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, and it's good to see everyone. Madam Chair and members, House File 740 is a bill supported and brought to me by ARM. It focuses on addressing payment rates for intermediate care facilities, often referred to as ICFs. ICFs are licensed supervised homes that care for individuals with developmental disabilities. There are approximately 126 ICFs in Minnesota, supporting 1,000 individuals. ICFs do not represent a large portion of the spectrum of services available, but for individuals that live in these homes, they are an important part of their lives. The last rate adjustment for an ICF home was received in 2015, and it was 1% increase. This bill will provide a 5% rate increase in 2021, as well as remove barriers that the ICFs face when requesting reimbursement for day services. Here to provide more detail is Sarah Grafstrom from ARM. And then, Madam Chair, I also have Rod Carlson, who is a provider of one of the homes. He manages one. He's not going to testify, but if members do have questions for him, I want to note that he is here to answer those questions. So, Madam Chair, if we could move to my testifier, Sarah Grafstrom, I would be appreciative.
Wonderful. Ms. Grafstrom, if you could please state your name for the record and any organizations that you are affiliated with as appropriate, and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Sarah Grafstrom, and I am the Director of State and Federal Policy with ARM. Our association represents almost 200 home and community-based service providers across the state. Thank you for this hearing and giving me the opportunity to testify on behalf of House File 740, which addresses variable rates and the services during the day service, as well as provides a 5% rate increase to ICF rates. ARM providers fully embrace the need to support the broad spectrum of supportive services for people with disabilities. However, as we continue to work with the legislature to address rates for waiver services, we are starting to see a growing gap in the rates that ICF providers receive relative to residential services for individuals on waivers. The first section of this bill will provide a 5% rate increase for ICFs across the state. The last increase, as Representative Edelson stated, that ICF providers received was in 2015, and that was at 1%. ICF rates were not impacted by the competitive workforce factor that was implemented by the legislature in 2019, although they are facing the same workforce staffing crisis that is being felt across disability services and often have staff that provide both support in an ICF and a waiver home. This issue can be demonstrated with an example from an ARM member located in the metro area. This member's services are made up of about half waiver services, half ICF services. At the end of 2019, they made the decision to increase the starting wage of all DSPs to $13.25 an hour. And as soon as the DSP passed the proper training, an additional increase to $13.75 an hour. This increase cost their organization $565,000 a year. However, because the competitive workforce factor only applies to waiver services, this organization's revenue was only increased by $163,000, leaving a gap of over $400,000. This is not a one-time cost, but an ongoing shortfall the organization will have to address. If nothing changes by year five, this increase will have cost the organization in excess over $2.8 million of non-reimbursed costs. causing the organization to either operate at a deficit or rely on fundraising dollars to make up the difference. In addition to the important steps this bill takes to address rates for ICF services, the bill also changes current policies that are in place for ICF providers. Section 2 and 3 of the bill make changes to the variable rate process. A variable rate is a change in rate for an individual due to increasing support needs. Currently, providers operating in ICF with a rate that is above the 50th percentile and median rates of an ICF are not allowed to request a variable rate for any individual, regardless of any changing needs or supports. House File 740 will remove that restriction, allowing for any ICF provider to request a variable rate for an individual if their needs change. This policy change is critical because in each individual's case, it is those working closest with them who have the best understanding of their support needs, and the ability to respond to that should not be restricted. Finally, Section 4 of the bill will allow providers to receive 100% of the rate that a DT&H provider receives when providing a service called services during the day. Services during the day is a service that an individual who lives in an ICF would access if they choose not to attend a day program or have a job. An individual may choose this service option for a variety of reasons, including the need for 24-hour nursing support, the health challenges presented by going out in cold or inclement weather, or because due to advancing age or increasing health concerns, they may by choice want to partially or fully retire from day services. Currently, providers are only reimbursed for providing this service at 75% of what the day program would have received to support the same individual. The need for this change was highlighted during this last year, as many individuals were required to stay home during the pandemic. ICF providers were only reimbursed at a portion of what that individual's rate would have been. With that, Madam Chair, I want to thank you again for hearing this bill and allowing me some time to describe some of the challenges that ICF services are facing. And I'd be happy to stand for any questions.
Thank you. Appreciate that, Ms. Grafstrom. And do we have any questions from members? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just wondering, are there other testifiers, or is DHS going to speak about this at all? Because this is an area of disability funding that I think members don't have as much familiarity with. And it's really hard to hear a bill like this kind of in isolation from that background information. So was there anything else here on the schedule for that?
I was going to say, do we have someone from DHS that perhaps could speak to that on the call today? Anyone? Am I missing them? Anyone? I am not.
Madam Chair.
Yes. There we go. Thank you. If you'd like to state your name for the record and go ahead and respond.
Madam Chair and members, Representative Liebling, thank you for the question. I'm not prepared to give an overview of ICFDB rates, but I'm certainly happy to follow up with more detailed information. I would just say that we have worked with ARM and with stakeholders on this legislation for the past several years, and they've been excellent to work with. We've worked very closely with our healthcare administration to craft this language, and we do think it makes sense. And aligns with our policy direction to make sure that the rates at these facilities are keeping pace. These are per diem rates that are flat rates that aren't increased on a regular schedule. So we do think it makes sense to look at these rates and adjust them accordingly.
All right, thank you for that. Miss, and is it Grom? Perhaps I'm saying that correctly. Thank you. Representative Liebling, did you have any follow-up questions?
Yeah, I do. Thank you. It's not so much a question as a comment. I mean, I know this has been the ICFDDs have been kind of the forgotten stepchild a little bit in the disability system. And so I'm not exactly sure why they are outside the home and community-based system, but there's some history here that I think would be helpful for members to know, and maybe at some point we'll have more opportunity in this committee to, if Chair Schultz
would want to do it to kind of go through that a little bit. The one, I guess, question I do have about the bill itself, and I'm glad to hear Ms. Grom say that, you know, this has been a work that they've worked with ARM to get to this language, because it is really complicated. And my understanding is that all these different facilities were like all at different rates. There hasn't been any sort of unifying principle here. And that is a problem. It can lead to some real unfairness. But the piece of the bill that talks about the day training piece that Ms. Grafstrom just discussed, where that it would be, the rate would be the same if the person stays home, so to speak, as if they go to a day training. I guess I'd like to just question that a bit, in the sense that what that really says, my understanding of a person goes to a day training and rehabilitation type of facility, that what they're getting there is programming. They're not just getting a place to be and sit. At least that's what it's supposed to be. And so if they're staying home because they're retired, or they, you know, just don't want to, or, I mean, people should have the right to do what they want to do. I don't really see why we would pay the same rate, frankly. We certainly, the rates need to go up overall. I get that. But why would you say that rate should be the same? Because if you do, you're kind of saying that what happens in those facilities is just, you know, just somebody's just being there. And then maybe we're paying them too much, if you get what I'm saying. So I'd like just a little more explanation of that piece. Thank you.
Representative Edelson or Ms. Grafstrom, would you like to speak to that?
Madam Chair, I will just say a few words to that, and I'll let Mrs. Grafstrom also address it. Chair Liebling, with the day services in the facility in the ICF, they are actually providing programming. And so, I mean, think about this last year, they haven't been able, individuals have not been able to go and access those. And they have actually created programming within the ICF. So, but they're reimbursed at a completely different rate. And so Mrs. Grafstrom, if you wanna go ahead and answer that a little bit additionally.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Liebling. And we do have a provider on the line that I think would probably be able to give really great examples of what services during the day look like. Oftentimes, our members share with me that even at 100% of the DTNH rate, it's a challenge to provide that service. Because if you think about the DTNH rate, that's often at a staffing ratio of 1-8, where when services are provided in an ICF, if it's just one individual from that ICF choosing to stay home, it's a one-to-one service. And to Representative Adelson's point, there is programming involved, lots of volunteer opportunities or activities to do during the day. It's certainly not just sitting at home.
Well, that's helpful. Thank you for that, Madam Chair and Ms. Grafstrom. I don't think I really need to hear from the other testifier. That does help me picture it a little bit better. I appreciate the answer.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. Representative Albright, to your question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll be brief. Good morning, Representative Edelson. I appreciate the efforts in House File 740, but candidly, you know, I understand that these rates have not been really truly affected since 2015, but just raising the rates, while that is an important step, it really doesn't go to the core problem of reimbursement. Across the board, what we're really doing is exacerbating or maintaining the disparity that we've already seen between the various service providers and geographic locations. And I'm wondering what you're doing on that venue, and I'm wondering if Ms. Grafstrom might speak to that as well. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Albright. That might be slightly outside the scope of the bill, but Representative Edelson or Ms. Grafstrom, would either of you like to speak to that?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Albright. Always good to see you. Mrs. Grafstrom, do you want to speak a little bit further about any ongoing work?
Yeah, thank you, Representative Edelson and Representative Albright. As Ms. Grom stated, we have been working hand in hand with the department over the last few years about what does the future of ICF services look like. So certainly this is not a long-term solution to address the funding mechanisms for these services. And we're eager to continue to engage with the department about, you know, what comes next and what is the long-term state vision for ICF services. This bill is really meant to start meeting some of the immediate needs that these providers face as far as staff wages and making sure that we're able to pay our direct support professionals a wage that keeps them in their position and try and meet some of the staffing needs that we have while we continue those long-term conversations with the department.
Thank you, Ms. Grafstrom. I know this is a continuing issue and one that certainly deserves our attention. I don't see any other questions from members. If there are no others, I'd like to give Representative Edelson an opportunity to give some closing comments before we lay the bill over. Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 740 is an important bill because it's really, ICFs have been left behind and they provide such a vital service to so many Minnesotans. And I just ask for your support and I ask for you to see this population of people. This housing works for them and this would really help move that dial a lot for this community. So thank you so much.
All right. Thank you, Representative Edelson. And with that, the bill will be laid over for possible inclusion in the Health Services Bill, HF 740 for the record. Thank you, Representative Edelson. And next we'll move on to, let's see, we have House File 1420. With Representative Hassan. The chair will move the bill before us and recommend that it be laid over for possible inclusion. Representative Hassan, it looks like you may have an amendment. Would you like to move the amendment?
Yes,
ma'am. Or would you like us to start by moving the amendment, I should say?
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you.
All right, thank you. And with that, the chair moves the A1 amendment for consideration. Chair, Representative Hassan, would you briefly like to address the contents of the A1?
Yes, Madam Chair and members, thank you for the opportunity hearing this bill today. The A1 amendment just puts the bill in a shape that the author, as well as the advocates that I've been working with want. It changed a few things. And let me, I can pull up my screen. There are four sections in the amendment. The first one requires the state adoption recruitment specialists to provide additional specific guidance to ensure that agencies focus on supporting relative caregivers and effective kin. And the second one creates foster care recruitment grants so that the community-based nonprofits, tribes, and other stakeholders with documented experience of working with families of color to recruit, engage, and support caregivers who are members of communities of color. And this is important when relatives and effective kin are an option to keep children within their community. The third one requires child placing agencies to develop strategies to recruit and support relative caregivers and effective kin when possible, and then caregivers who are members of communities of color. And the final section is an appropriation for the grant of the program.
Okay, and I think we need to speak first to the A1. Are there any questions specific to the amendment from any of the members? Seeing none, we will vote on the amendment to move that. Members, please unmute yourselves. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any aye. Opposed? All right. Aye. Wonderful. Thank you. Then we will have the bill before us, House File 1420 as amended. Representative Hassan, would you like to speak to your bill?
Yes, Madam Chair. Again, thank you for the opportunity sent House File 1420, which is an act relating to human service, child protection, establishing additional relative foster care case management, licensing support, training services, and resources. We have a positive trend in Minnesota. Placement of children in need of foster care with kinship caregivers has increased significantly over the past years, with 2019 data reflecting 60.9% of days of care for Minnesota children in out-of-home placement being with kinship caregivers. This is good news. As we know, children statistically have better lifelong outcomes when placed with kin who they know and love, as they experience the most traumatic event of their life, which is an out-of-home placement. The challenge now is for Minnesota to shift our foster care system to reflect this positive trend in kinship placement and provide active support for kinship caregivers to have success in licensing, access to needed services for children, and most importantly, have the responsive support needed to provide loving parenting to kin children in their care. House File 1420 was designed by providers and advocates based on the increasing concern that kinship caregivers are too frequently lacking the basic support needed to be successful. Evidence of this is clear from the following. The increased number of disruptions of children who are being placed in new foster care homes due to kinship placement not working out. Community-based providers fielding frequent calls to assistance from kinship caregivers seeking basic information and support to parents, the children in their care in the absence of active licensing or case management support from counties. Family members who have been overlooked and told that they're ineligible for licensing, seeking support from a variety of sources as they are doing all they can to become the caregivers for their relative children. This data is not part of our child welfare dashboard, and it's very difficult to track. You have a kinship care community data handout in your packet with qualitative data collected by providers and advocates with greater context in this challenge. This is a system problem to deliver the specialized response support required by kinship caregivers as they receive relative children they had not planned to care for. We need to update our system and shift some of the burden from our county system to state support and to community-based providers who are by design oriented to respond to family needs. We have learned that the counties have some concerns with this language, and we're very happy to work with them in improving the language to address these concerns. Today, I have a family members to share their experience, and Susanna Burns from Evolve Family Services, an expert in kinship caregiving, to further explain the need for this bill.
All right, thank you, Representative Hassan. As Representative Hassan mentioned, there are a number of pieces of written testimony and additional supporting materials in your packets. With that, I believe we do have four testifiers here for us today. I'll just kind of give the blanket reminder to our testifiers to please state your name for the record and name of your organization, if appropriate. And we want to please try to limit ourselves to 2 minutes to make sure that we are able to hear from each of our testifiers and make sure that all of your voices are heard. With that, I believe the first on the list that I have today is Ms. Barnes from Evolve Family Services.
Good morning. My name is Susanna Barnes, and I am the Executive Director at Evolve Family Services. And I'm very appreciative of the opportunity to be connecting with you all today in support of House File 1420. After seeing underserved relative caregivers in our community and with the support of key county partners, Evolve shifted to focus specifically on kinship care beginning in 2016. Since then, we have served over 300 youth in relative placements and 219 relative families. 79% of the youth that we are serving are children of color, and 57% of our kinship caregivers are Black, Indigenous, and people of color. This disproportionate representation of children of color underscores an even greater importance in keeping children within their family systems, community, and culture of origin. Kinship families need responsive care and specialized support to meet licensing standards while actively caring for their relatives. Foster care licensing involves significant paperwork, background checks, trainings, home preparation, and a very invasive assessment process. There are lengthy procedures for requesting reconsideration around any issues with the potential to disqualify them. We have found through our work that supporting kinship families through licensing takes more than double the time of working with non-relative foster parents. Community-based organizations are well positioned to reduce barriers for relative caregivers. We hold smaller caseloads, allowing us to provide personalized care, meet with families multiple times per month, walk through paperwork together, assist through obtaining necessary resources, provide in-person care throughout the length of the placement, and work through concerns and crises as they arise. In response to family needs, we provide specialized trainings on the unique dynamics from shifting roles from grandmother to that of trauma-informed parental caregiving role. We provide support in navigating dynamics within larger family systems, as caregivers can be a vital resource in reunifying the children with their parents and preserving family relationships. As a result of this, families are having their needs met, getting resources established, and are better able to support the youth that are in their care. Through our in-depth work, we are seeing increased systemic challenges for kin. Counties are not set up consistently or equitably with resources around kinship care. Families often have to navigate on their own with little guidance or advocacy. In some cases, inadequate searches mean that relatives may never be engaged. Some relatives are even actively dissuaded from beginning the process, being told that they have barriers when these are often issues that can be overcome with support. If the county won't consider them, they are left on their own. And without support, families may feel the process is insurmountable and give up. Counties have cited reticence in working with private agencies related to concerns in their ability as the county to fund the work. And community-based organizations have expertise and ability, but lack funding to sustainably take on this work. Kinship care is a priority, and active support is needed to increase and sustain kinship families. This bill provides tangible resources to help our systems adapt, address barriers, and decrease the burden on counties while giving the family the option to seek services from qualified community-based providers. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Barnes. And next on the list, I have Lucille O'Quinn. Again, please state your name and any affiliation for the record.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Lucille O'Quinn, who is aunt, licensed relative caregiver of two nephews, Darius and Amir Baker. I'm here to support HF 1420. My story began in 2017 when one of three of my nephews went into foster care with a white non-relative foster family. January of 2019, my second nephew was born and placed with the same white non-relative family. I was able to be contacted in 2019, 2 years after my nephew had been with a non-relative provider. However, when I found out about the second baby was born by the bio parent, I made many attempts to contact county workers to be considered. Sad to say, when I was considered a placement option, my first nephew had already been adopted. In June, I began the licensing process, which wasn't easy because I had to give up a relationship with my vulnerable adult brother so that I could get through the requirements of licensing. Even after I was disqualified, it took me 4 months to hear back from the state about having to be have a set aside without the help and support of the private agency that I'm dealing with now. I feel like I would have been approved right now today. After licensing, challenges still continue with nephew number three being born and placed in my care. The non-relative foster parents who adopted number one nephew continues to fight for both my nephews and my custody. She intervened on many court cases and also attempted to get my own children removed. Many times I felt like giving up, but this experience have also shown me why many families walk away from this process, because I have felt like that many times. I am thankful for the support that was available throughout the private agency I worked with.
The knowledge and extra resources to navigate throughout these challenges. Here I had the advice, input, and lean on the emotional support or even other additional resources to be a successful parent. Both being a licensed relative caregiver has brought lots of challenges. I am thankful that I had the support I needed. And most of all, I am thankful that I can keep my nephews in the African-American culture within our family system. For me, my story ends well. I will be adopting my two nephews in the next few months. However, I do know lots of families don't have resources and support to hold on to. Nevertheless, the scariest thing about being a foster parent is having to walk away from the support of the agency who have been supportive to me throughout the last 2 years. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. O'Quinn, and congratulations on your pending adoption. I know raising children is a bit of a labor of love, so thank you for rising to the challenge of caring for those little ones. I truly appreciate that. Next up, thank you. All right, next on our list, we have Ms. Reeves. Ms. Reeves? Do we have Ms. Reeves?
Yes, ma'am. I am here.
All right. If you could just
give me a second. I'm going to pull over and park because I was in transit the whole time.
All right. Well, we want you to be safe.
Yes, so ma'am. Please, I'm getting off the highway now. I'm pulling over.
All right. And when it's safe, if you want to, are you able to go or should we move on to the next testifier and come back in a moment?
I am able and ready.
All right. I just want to make sure you're safe. All right. If you'd like to go ahead and state your full name for the record and go ahead. And we are trying to keep it to 2 minutes to make sure that we're on task and make sure everyone gets heard.
Yes, ma'am.
All right.
Hello, everyone. Madam Chair and members of the Chair Committee, my name is Geraldine Reeves, and I am a grandmother and was licensed relative caregiver for my two Native American grandchildren that were placed in the foster care system, ages 7 and 11. And I am here to support HF 1420, because my story starts out when I found out that I had a three-year-old grandchild in the foster care system. I didn't want my grandkids to be subjected to the system and that they needed to be with family. I had already raised all of my adult children, so making the decision to parent young kids again, that was a major adjustment for me. Even though I was never initially contacted for caregiver rights of my grandchildren, I made the decision to move back to Minnesota from Texas and figure out how to get my grandkids out the system. So when I first started this process, I was told I couldn't get licensed by the county, and I didn't accept no as an answer. So I Googled other agencies, and I found three of them, private agencies. Two of them wanted me to pay, which I didn't have the finances for. And then I called Evolve. And Evolve contacted me and took me on as a client. And they agreed to help me to get licensed. They assisted me with licensing and advocating for my grandchildren to be placed in my care. And despite the system that was set up against me, I was able to overcome all of these obstacles and barriers that I found an agency that supported me. And that was very important in this process because, like Lucille, I became very overwhelmed with the process. And many occasions I said I was gonna just say, forget it, it wasn't worth it, because of all the things I had to encounter and the negativity and adverse situations that came my way, I wasn't prepared for. But because of Evolve, I had somebody there that would listen to me vent, assist me, and give me wise counsel, and not what I wanted to hear at that time. So my grandkids were placed in my care as of April 12th of 2020 on Easter Sunday. And I worked with Evolve for 2 years, and once they moved in with me, it wasn't easy. That was just the beginning. And they needed many services and supports to be set up, and it was challenging to continue working with the county system and feel like my voice wasn't being heard. And throughout the challenges, I'm thankful that I always had someone I could call and ask questions, vent my frustrations to, and provide me with advice and assistance setting up supports. Now that my grandkids are with family, I continue to keep them connected with their parents and our family culture. And thank you to Evolve and their outstanding support in my transition to being a foster parent and now as an adoptive parent as of November 17, 2020. Hallelujah. There needs to be more agencies like this to support and help families. I'm so thankful and grateful to Evolve. I thank you guys for putting this on your bill to revamp the system, whatever helps the kids, because they are our future. And I'm just thankful and grateful. that I made it. I'm a survivor.
Thank you, Ms. Reeves. And, you know, I just, well, first of all, congratulations on the adoption and for the courageous effort. You know, I think there's nothing better than kiddos knowing that someone is not only in their corner, but willing and ready to fight for them. And I am certain that your grandchildren will certainly appreciate that as the path continues. So thank you for all of that. With that, we do have one last testifier, Ms. Hennen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Stacey Hennen. I'm the Human Services Director at Grant, Pope, and Traverse Counties. I'm also the Legislative Chair for the Minnesota Association of County Social Services Administrators, representing Human Services Directors in all 87 counties. Max of Values Relatives is a critical resource for the children and families that we serve. For many reasons, including racial and cultural reasons, it's imperative that children are placed with a relative or kin whenever possible. Minnesota Statute 260C.221 requires that the responsible social services agency conduct relative searches. The state standard for relative placements is 35.7%, and Minnesota's performance in 2020 was 67.5%. The rate of relative placements has increased over the years. It demonstrates counties' commitment to search for and identify relatives as foster care options, as well as permanency options for children when necessary. MAXA does believe that relative foster care providers would benefit from additional support if additional funding becomes available. MAXA supports the state taking advantage of federal resources made available to support and build out a statewide kinship program. Counties also support the grants proposed in the A1 amendment with the goal of recruiting and supporting prospective foster families and adoptive families who are members of communities of color and reflect the racial and ethnic background of the population of children experiencing out-of-home placement in Minnesota. However, MAXA is opposed to the legislation as drafted, which would require counties to refer relatives to a private community organization for licensing support, training, and case management services. The bill as designed creates significant negative impacts on counties regarding relative search and placement work currently underway. Throughout and after the work group Aspire convened on this topic, counties have provided feedback to Aspire expressing our concerns. Those concerns are not reflected in the current language. The proposal as written is not always feasible and is not financially viable for counties. Private agencies charge counties administrative rates on top of the foster care cost of the child per placement, and those rates range from approximately $28 to $75 per day per child. This bill also puts counties outside of the metro in a vulnerable position because private community-based organizations are not readily available in outstate Minnesota to provide the required services and contracts, or the services and contracts required by this bill. Creating a requirement for something that doesn't exist statewide with no plan for how to build it out and then asking counties to pay for it is not only a burden, but an unrealistic expectation and distraction for counties from the work for that statistics show we're currently doing and improving on all the time. Thank you for allowing me to testify on this matter.
Thank you, Ms. Hennen. And Representative Hassan, I know that you briefly addressed this earlier, but perhaps you might have some additional comments you'd like to add.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I want to thank Ms. Stacy for her testimony. We are more than happy to work with the counties, like I said in my opening statement, to figure out a way to better this bill and to make sure that it can do what it needs to do and not put a burden on the counties. I used to be a social worker. I used to be a child protection social worker. And I, you know, firsthand know the disparities, the inequities that exist in the system. So we are not trying to, you know, put a burden on the counties, but what we're trying to do is do what's best for the children. And what's best for the children is A, being placed with their relative and kin, when being placed in foster care, and B, we need to support those families because they're all of a sudden raising, as you heard the testimony, you know, one day you find out that your, you know, relative child needs, you know, somebody to care for them. That was not in your plan, just like the grandmother who raised her own children and now is raising her grandchildren. We need to have a plan to support those families, to provide them an easy process to license, as well as case management and support continued support. So we're more than happy to work with the counties. Ms. Burns, do you have anything to add to that?
Ms. Burns.
Yes, I would just agree that I think there's certainly ability to work on the language of the bill. And I think the key piece is creating the option for families, not necessarily a mandatory referral, but the option for families to be able to utilize private organizations, particularly in circumstances when the county has indicated that they're perhaps not willing or unable to serve the family.
All right. Very good. Thank you for that. Certainly, I appreciate, and I know we're all on the same page and wanting to do what's absolutely best for our kiddos. And it's very clear from the testifiers, both for and against, that is, in fact, the mission and that we're all working toward the same goal. So thank you for that. Do we have any questions from members, for Representative Hassan? For any of our testifiers, and I do know we also have with us today available for questions, Ms. Boo from NACAC, we have Ms. Anderson from Aspire Minnesota, as well as a host of folks from the Children and Family Services and Child Safety and Permanency for questions. Any? Well, apparently Representative Hassan has done such a great job. I'm not seeing any questions. That being the case, Representative Hassan, would you like to have just a brief moment to kind of make some closing remarks?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members, for indulging this conversation with me. This is an important conversation. It's about what's best for our young children. It's about equity, and as we know, Minnesota, you know, when we look at equity, those numbers are always heartbreaking to look at, that we are not serving, Black communities, Indigenous communities, and communities of color. So with that, I appreciate your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hassan. And with that, the chair will move that House File 1420 be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Representative Hassan. All right, and last but not least on our agenda for today, we do have House File 1822, which will be laid over for possible inclusion as well. As the chair moves to bring 1822 before the committee, and we have Representative Waldman here to speak to that bill. Welcome back. Representative Waldman, would you like to speak to your bill?
Yes, I would. Thank you very much, Vice Chair Bonner and committee members. I'm here today to present this bill, which was brought to me by the Association of Minnesota Counties, the Minnesota Association of County Social Service Administrators, and the Minnesota Intercounty Association. Madam Vice Chair and members, as you know, the COVID-19 pandemic changed the world for everyone, but perhaps no one more than our state's most vulnerable. In the days, weeks, and months since the virus hit our state, Minnesota counties have worked closely with DHS and the legislature to ensure that services are delivered efficiently and safely. The peacetime emergency waivers and modifications that were issued by DHS and extended by the legislature have permitted county staff to change the delivery method of services without sacrificing service quality by doing such things as conducting client meetings via video and processing enrollment paperwork remotely. Counties have learned that some of the best practices and believe that some of the waivers and modifications demonstrate a better, more efficient way to deliver services in a way that promotes the safety and well-being of county clients and staff, and may have the added benefit of preserving limited state and county resources. While counties have found that many of the waivers are beneficial and critical during the pandemic, they have evaluated the current COVID-19 waivers and have prioritized four waivers that should be made permanent. Madam Vice Chair and members, this bill codifies these four priorities that will help improve and streamline county services and provide lasting benefits for clients. With that, Madam Vice Chair, with your permission, I'll turn it over to my testifiers. I have here Sherburne County Commissioner Lisa Phoebe and Stacy Hennen, who is the Grant County Social Services Director, to highlight these benefits and efficiencies and further explain the details of this bill.
Wonderful. Thank you, Representative Wolkamott. And with that, we'll start with Commissioner Phoebe. If you could again state your name for the record and your affiliation, and then proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Vice Chair Bonner and committee members. My name is Lisa Phoebe, and I'm a Sherburne County Commissioner here today to testify in support of Representative Wolkamott's House File 1822. Thank you, Representative Wolkamott, for authoring this bill focused on improving our human service processes. Last year, the Association of Minnesota Counties, many of you may have heard, we convened a Blue Ribbon Committee on County Government Operations that reviewed in real time changes in county operations as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic. I was proud to serve on this committee with county commissioners from across the state, probably perhaps some in the counties that you represent. Our goal and charge was to examine the lessons learned about county government operations during the pandemic and the emergency and recommend permanent changes in federal, state, and county operations to provide more effective and efficient services to Minnesotans. Early in the committee's work, we focused on changes in human services operations, examining the more than 60 waivers or changes in processes that were adopted by executive order. Our committee recommended a list of waivers that should be extended beyond the peacetime emergency, both for transition time and to allow for time to study their effectiveness. In the months since, we have further refined our list of proposed permanent process changes to the four included in House File 1822. I'd like to share a short background on how we got to this list of four waivers, and then Stacy Hennen, representing MACSA, we'll describe the four waivers in more detail. Our Blue Ribbon Committee knew that the human services waivers granted by the governor during the pandemic would expire at the end of the peacetime state of emergency. The need for a transition period was clear and was a top priority for us. Counties recognize that it is not in the best interest of Minnesotans to simply flip a switch and return to county business as usual when the peacetime emergency declaration ends. As we transition to the end of the peacetime emergency, county staff will also be required to reduce backlogs in a number of program areas that were rightfully delayed during the emergency. There will be heavy workloads in the short term, which a transition period will help to manage. Therefore, we advocated for and appreciated the passage of legislation during last summer's special sessions that included a 60-day extension of all human service waivers beyond the end of the peacetime emergency to allow for this orderly transition. We appreciate the House and Senate working in a bipartisan manner to pass this legislation. Making some of these process changes permanent was also a high priority of this Blue Ribbon Committee. Our human service directors in MACSA identified a prioritized list of 13 process changes that showed promise for long-term effectiveness. They improved efficiency, improved access, and protected the health and safety of our staff and clients while protecting program integrity. We worked with Chair Liebling and others to extend these waivers through the end of the 2021 session so that counties, DHS, and the legislature had time to explore these waivers more fully outside the time constraints and pressure of a special session. From that list of 13 priorities from last summer, we return to you today with four specific provisions to prioritize for permanent adoption as a part of House File 1822. I want to also note that others of the 13 priority waivers are being carried in other bills, as you may know, such as Representative Morrison's telehealth bill. The four process improvements in Representative Wolkamott's bill focus specifically on the unique county role in human services and are the ones prioritized in conjunction with a vetting process by AMC's human services affiliate, MACSA. As I close, I want to note that I believe these process improvements are one silver lining of this very challenging past year. Counties were forced to rapidly change our business processes to ensure the needs of Minnesotans were met. I believe we persevered through this challenge and have emerged perhaps in even a better place. Thank you again, Representative Waldgemont, Chair Schultz, and committee members for your support. I'm sorry, Chair Bonner, and for your support of counties and these process improvements. And with that, I would like to turn it over to Stacey Hennen, representing MACSA, while she'll describe the four waivers in a bit more detail. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Phoebe. Ms. Hennen, would you like to go ahead and state your name for the record and your affiliation and proceed with your testimony?
Thank you. Yes, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Stacey Hennen. I am the Human Services Director for Grant, Pope, and Traverse County. I'm the Legislative Chair for the Minnesota Association of County Social Services Administrators, or MACSA. So I'm here representing Human Services Directors in all 87 counties. I think that Commissioner Phoebe has already talked eloquently about the challenges that counties faced and the way that we've had to kind of pivot and turn our services and change our services to meet the needs of people. I think that what we did with that is we constantly assessed throughout that process what was working and what wasn't working, what had the ability to continue to work, and what really needed to be a short-term kind of solution for things. So we have narrowed it down to, as she said, 13 things, and four of them are in this prayer, in this bill. We found that the additional flexibility has resulted in these areas, has resulted in the capability to provide greater flexibility in serving people, offering more choices for how they interact with the county and with community partners who share the work with us. A number of the priority flexibilities are also found in Senator Rosen's telehealth bill, Senate File 1160. And several are being heard in other bills as well. Counties are seeking to permanently extend four changes. Those four changes, I'd like to spend a bit of time talking about them. The first one is to eliminate face-to-face orientation for Minnesota Family Investment Program, or MFIP, and allow agencies to accept MFIP applications over the phone. Completing applications over the phone means saving time for residents, as well as eliminating the barrier of transportation needs and costs in more rural areas. It also allows counties to be able to offer orientation remotely and aligns with economic assistance programs like SNAP. So in the process of, it would simplify our processes too, because other areas we are allowed to do that first visit via telephone. It still requires the county to receive a signed written application within 30 days of submitting their application, and it still requires an interview to be conducted. So it doesn't change some of those core things, but it does allow for easier, better access for people. Second one that's considered in this bill is to allow certain reassessments for long-term services to be conducted remotely. Reassessments done virtually or by phone can work well for those who are stable and have little need for service changes. This does not impact initial assessments. Those are going to continue to remain face-to-face. The parameters set up in this bill allows for this in cases where the client, their guardian, the account, and the county case manager agree that a remote reassessment is in the best interest of the client. An example of that is if a person's guardian is located out of state, they can join a reassessment meeting. We can do it via Zoom or via phone, and that allows us to be more flexible for their scheduling, and then they could be present to help meet the needs of the person that they're the guardian for, and family caregivers can be more present as well. So we think that would be helpful not only to counties, but helpful to the people that we serve and to their families and being more engaged in their process and their services. The third one is to allow targeted case management visits to be conducted remotely. This option would be available to conduct a case management visit remotely on certain occasions under certain circumstances. Recipients of services have so far responded positively to the increased flexibility in fulfilling their assessment requirements and service delivery. Post-pandemic, many of the people that we serve will be really glad to see in person again, and we'll be really glad to be doing our face-to-face contacts in person again, too. But we've also learned that allowing some of this flexibility in phone and video conferencing with an agreed-upon standard of care can improve accessibility and efficiencies for people. We have worked and continue to work with DHS on technical assistance to navigate the appropriate language in this bill to consider existing state law and federal law, and we're aware that aspects of these provisions remain subject to federal approval. In the end, our goal is to standardize all forms of targeted case management, including child welfare targeted case management. We want to ensure that language that moves forward balances the elements of quality and quantity. We know that Senator Rosen's bill also includes similar language. We look forward to working with the authors on aligning the language. And the last one is to allow for certain exceptions to the absence policy and housing support. Allowing this flexibility is critical to protect those individuals who need extended medical treatment or hospitalization from losing housing. We know that stability in housing is crucial for those seeking treatment, and this flexibility prevents unnecessary churn or turnover and supports stability for those who qualify for housing support and are facing other medical challenges. This extends the absence allowed up to 150 days per year when an individual is absent due to residential behavioral health treatment or inpatient healthcare treatment. An example of that is that there are times that people have had to choose between retaining their housing or seeking medical care or treatment services. This flexibility has allowed people to not have to make this difficult choice and to actively engage their healthcare without worry for their housing. This bill allows for positive ongoing change for Minnesota's most vulnerable populations. We appreciate your leadership on this important topic, and we thank you for the opportunity to testify on this today.
Thank you, Ms. Hennen. Certainly, we can appreciate one of the great parts about, they like to say that necessity is the mother of invention. And certainly, while no one ever wanted the pandemic by any stretch of the imagination, certainly I appreciate the process improvements and innovations that have come out of this. The need there being really apparent, and especially, you know, finding ways to be more flexible to meet the needs of those that we serve. So I really appreciate that, and particularly the good attention to detail in this bill that shows how we can use those lessons learned to find good approaches that really serve people. And of course, to provide a good off-ramp for those executive orders as we work to get back to normal, or whatever that may look like in the near future. So thank you for all the collaboration on that, and to Representative Wolgamott. I am not seeing any hands up for questions. I can certainly give Representative Wolgamott the last word, but there's one. All right, thank you. Representative Robbins, if you would please go ahead and state your question.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Wolgamott, and your testifiers. I have several questions. I've heard other versions of this bill, and I know we're almost out of time, so I think the main concern I have is about eliminating these face-to-face interviews, especially for MFIB. And I appreciate that from a previous committee step, now you are requiring that they still have to provide the signed form within 30 days and a face-to-face interview still has to be conducted. I think that's an improvement from last time I heard this somewhere. So I really appreciate that, but I'm still concerned that if information provided over the phone is not accurate or is misheard or something's filled out wrong, and then you do get to the 30 days, you have the signed form and you go through the verification process, they've already been approved and then you find out that they don't qualify, how do you unwind that?
So Wolgamott, or do we have Commissioner Phoebe, Ms. Hennen?
I can answer this question if you'd like me to, Madam Chair.
Yes, please.
Typically, we have 30 to 45 days to process the application. So my, at least from our experience, we wouldn't finalize. We wouldn't until we have the actual application in hand. So we would verify those things. That's the intent, is that before it's finalized, we would have the actual paper application, because we do need to verify things. We need to make sure it's all accurate. So I don't think that would change our process. We would have to have the signed application in hand. It just allows for that first visit to be done remotely, but it doesn't change any of the other eligibility standards. So I think we would still spend our 30 days gathering the information, and we'd need that signed application to review and verify certain parts of it.
And Representative Robbins, I think you said you had one additional question.
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you. And on the housing supports, I just want to understand, I think it's a great idea. I'm generally supportive of it, but so the state would pay for their treatment and continue to pay for their housing that's not being used. So I'm just trying to understand the fiscal impact of it.
I can also try to answer that if that's okay, Madam Chair. I would say that actually typically the medical treatment is paid for through the medical assistance. This would just allow the housing supports to continue. So both of those things would already be covered. They're eligible for both those services. This would just prevent them from being removed from the housing supports when they're exercising. If they're going to substance use disorder treatment, if they're in mental health treatment, it would allow them to not lose one or the other. So it would pay for both of them. I don't know that it would be exceptionally different right now, in the sense that it does pay for a certain number of absent days. We're just increasing it to recognize that sometimes people's mental health or their issues require more than what those minimum absent days are right now.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you.
I can't remember your last name on the screen, but thank you to the testifier. And just to clarify, current law, I believe, allows 18 days of absence, and the new statute would provide 150 days, which is substantially different from a fiscal impact. So will there be a fiscal note on this, or how will we know what that change will cost?
Yes. Thank you, Representative Robbins. Representative Walgamont, did you want to speak to that? And it looks like we also have a member of fiscal staff on, if you'd like to defer, Representative Walgamont.
Thank you.
All right.
You get a more thorough answer from a member of fiscal staff. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Berg, if you'd like to speak to that.
Madam Chair and Representative Robbins, it won't be a much more thorough answer, just to say there is a pending fiscal note to assess what the impact of this legislation is. As soon as that's available, it'd be circulated to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Berg. And just a reminder, this bill is being laid over for possible inclusion, so we can certainly revisit that fiscal note and have that conversation. So just want to be clear that that is the path for this bill at the moment. Representative Robbins, does that answer your questions?
It does. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Well, with 3 minutes left to spare, I would like to then give Representative Walgamont just a brief moment to give any closing comments before we lay this bill over for possible inclusion.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and thank you, members, for taking the time to hear this bill. I ask that we come together and that we support our counties and the people that they serve, and would appreciate your consideration of this in an omnibus bill. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Walgamont. And with that, we will lay the bill over for possible inclusion. And thank you to members, to our legislators, and to our testifiers for keeping us on track. With that, we have actually concluded the agenda, so we will not need to meet this evening at 6 o'clock. I'm sure that is music to everyone's ears. So thank you all for your time today. And with that, I will adjourn this meeting. Thank you, everyone.